This is So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Cambridge Community Radio. Hello again, we're back on the internet after all the fun of 209's temporary FM broadcast. I am Hannah Higginson.
And I am Derek Thorne, and over the next half hour we'll be reminding you of just how many globally flavoured events there are taking place in Cambridge. On the programme tonight,
the Chinese author Jinran tells us about the reality of life in China, something she believes people in the West don't know enough about.
We speak to the director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria, a massive organisation that's raising billions every year to prevent and treat these big three diseases.
And what does Islam have to say about caring for the environment?
This is So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio, and don't forget that you can get in touch with us via our email address, which is sofar@209radio.co.uk. And you can even podcast our show too. Click on the podcast icon on the show's page and head for the frequently asked questions if you have any trouble.
But firstly, today, the forum at CB1 is becoming a regular feature on So Far and Yet So Near. The last one was held on Tuesday the 21st of February, and it was a talk about the campaign against the arms trade. Anna Jones, campaigns and events coordinator, told us what the campaign was all about.
So the Campaign Against the Arms Trade is a campaigning organisation which exists to try and reduce and ultimately end arms exports from the UK to other countries. We aim to do this through a few different steps to get to that point. Initially, to end subsidies by the British government to arms companies and to the arms trade, and to support international regulation of the arms trade, and to support non-violent means of resolving conflict through organisations like the United Nations.
So tell us a little bit about how the UK government does support the arms trade currently.
The UK government subsidises the arms trade to the tune of about £900 million, and that's divided up in a number of ways. It pays direct costs for research and development for the arms industry, so they don't have to pay their own costs on research. It provides government support in the form of government ministers, royalty, going out to countries and lobbying on behalf of arms companies for those governments in those countries to buy arms from the UK. It also supports events like the arms fairs that happen in London every 2 years and happen in Cambridge every so often as well, just outside Cambridge at Duxford arms fairs, which are about promoting the latest weaponry to governments around the world. And the UK government will provide funding for that to happen and will provide the kind of red carpet for the delegations coming viewing the weaponry.
You were talking before about one of your campaigns particularly focuses on these arms fairs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Arms fairs are big events. They look like public events. Actually, they're very private events, but they happen in public places, in local communities, in exhibition halls around the world. And they are the places where the companies exhibit their weaponry and government delegations from around the world come and look at that weaponry.
And what is your campaign focusing on connected to these arms trade?
So our campaign is focusing on trying to get the private company which runs the arms fairs on behalf of the UK government to stop organising arms fairs. For that company to say, this is not a viable business to be in, it's a dirty business, and we no longer want to be part of it. We're focusing particularly on a company called Reed Elsevier, who are a huge publishing company, who are most famous for the information services that they provide to a raft of different professions, from academic journals to big website search databases and educational textbooks. So Harcourt Education is owned by Reed Elsevier, and they provide textbooks for secondary school children. And another part of what they do is organising trade events, trade exhibitions, including the London Book Fair and the Food and Wine Fair, and arms fairs. So we're saying that this company, which does incredibly good work for a huge number of professionals, that it shouldn't also be helping the arms trade, which is incredibly damaging and destructive trade, to help it in its business.
That was Anna Jones from the London head office of the Campaign Against the Arms Trade. The campaign also has a Cambridge arm, which has a slightly different focus. Richard Rippin, a member of the group, told us all about the local campaign.
basically been running since last September. And it's a group of people, some students, some people from the town who are basically campaigning to get publicly funded bodies such as the colleges and the university and also the local authorities, the city and county councils, to disinvest money that they currently have invested through their pension funds in the arms trade.
So what do you do to campaign?
Okay, so it's kind of happening on various different fronts. The students are gathering information through via the Freedom of Information Act. They're now able to get information on where colleges are investing a lot of their money. So they're basically getting that information together and disseminating that amongst the student population and generally raising awareness of the issue of the arms trade with students through having stalls and getting people signing petitions and so on with a view to ultimately putting pressure on the colleges to take that money and invest it elsewhere and to implement ethical investment policies generally.
So if you can tell us about some of the successes and failures of Cambridge Cats campaign.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the main thing we're doing is raising awareness, and I think that's always going to be really valuable. So far, we've been getting in touch with a lot of college bursars on the university side and getting mixed responses, some more positive than others, but generally developing this pool of information, which is really valuable. In terms of the county council, I guess it's been, again, a mixed bag. It was a success in that we were able to go and ask a question, what's called a public question, to a full council meeting. Which, you know, enabled us to go and engage in the democratic process. It was a bit disappointing in that the response of the county councillors was not very welcoming. We were given less than a warm welcome. But we think there's still a lot of mileage in the campaign in terms of putting pressure on the county and indeed other local authorities to disinvest from the arms trade.
And one of the arguments that is often used is that sort of if the pension funds disinvest from these arms companies, money will be lost. It's not economically viable. What's your response to that?
Well, there's been some excellent research done that's shown that ethical investment certainly need not be economically in any way damaging. Arms companies actually account for only about 2% of the British economy. And research shows that you can actually exclude up to 25% of companies on ethical grounds from your investment portfolio without it having any negative impact at all. The Church of England is a good example of an organisation that has an ethical investment policy. Its funds perform perfectly well, and there's no appreciable difference from funds that will invest willy-nilly in companies without ethical concern.
You can contact the Cambridge branch of the Campaign Against the Arms Trade through cambridgeaction.net, and their main website is all the W's at caat.org.uk.
This is So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio, and without doubt the current series of Darwin lectures organised by Darwin College at the University is providing us with some lovely stuff to talk about. And a couple of weeks ago the subject was surviving disease, and the very distinguished speaker was Professor Richard Feacham, who is the director of the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria. Those diseases are sometimes referred to as the Big Three because they kill 6 million people every year. And Professor Feacham was kind enough to tell me all about what the Global Fund is doing to fight them, including a brand new initiative that involves big business.
The Global Fund is purely finance. We're not a development organisation. We're not a technical assistance organisation. We don't replicate the World Health Organization. We're a social investment bank. We raise large amounts of money. We've so far raised $9 billion with a B, US dollars. And we invest it in 130 countries, developing countries, poorer countries, in programs that are prevention programs, testing programs, and treatment programs against AIDS and TB and malaria.
$9 billion is a massive number, but I mean, how does it compare to the amount that's needed?
Well, the amount that's needed is variously estimated at maybe between $15 billion a year and $25 billion a year. We're up to $9 billion, but we're only actually investing between $1 and $2 billion each year, climbing year on year. Now, of course, the Global Fund is not the only source of finance. There are a variety of players in this financing field. We are just the big and rapidly growing one.
So there are some new initiatives that you've been talking about. So please tell me about Product Red.
Well, when the Global Fund was created, it was always the intention that we would be a public-private partnership, which is a trendy phrase and often doesn't mean very much, but we take it very seriously. And in relation to our income, that means that we should not only be funded by governments And today we're almost entirely funded by governments, but we should also be funded by corporations and individual citizens who feel and have some passion about the problem of HIV/AIDS, particularly in Africa. So we've been searching over the last 2 years for a large and sustainable scheme, and those two words are critical. It's got to be large and it's got to be sustainable, to generate corporate giving and individual citizen giving to the Global Fund. And Product Red is the outcome of that 2 years of work. We launched it with Bono, the lead singer of U2, and four companies have initially joined. Those are American Express, Nike, Gap, and Armani. Other companies are queuing up to join, which is great. And in every case, a company will designate a certain range of products that they make as being red products. And when people choose to buy red, a proportion of what they spend comes directly to the Global Fund.
Are those products actually red?
Some are and some aren't. The Amex card for red is a red card. The initial line of clothing from Gap is red, but other colors as well. So the answer is, not everything and not always, but you'll know the brand. When you walk into the store, typically there will be a red area, and if you shop in that area, you're shopping red and you're helping fight AIDS in Africa.
Now, this is quite an adventurous project, and I can imagine there have been some criticisms. I mean, have there been any?
Well, there's been a certain amount of carping from the left flank, I would say, but I think it's based on a misunderstanding of what we're doing here. The key thing about this scheme is the large and sustainable. And it won't be large and it won't be sustainable unless it's in the company's self-interest. So this is not charity and this is not corporate philanthropy. For the companies, they believe that they will improve their bottom line, and the fact that it's good for them makes it sustainable. For the customer, for the shopper, for the man and woman in the street, it's not an act of charity. I'm not going into the shop to buy something I wouldn't normally buy or I don't really want in order to feel good for 10 minutes. I'm just doing my normal shopping and I'm choosing to shop red rather than to shop otherwise. And that's the key. That's what makes it sustainable and that's what makes it potentially large as other companies join.
Now let's look to the future slightly. There was recently a news report about a certain area of Zimbabwe having a reduction, I think, in prevalence of HIV. I mean, is this something that you think we might be seeing more of? Are we starting to win the battle?
I think in some places we are starting to win the battle. One has to be very cautious because the numbers are always unreliable, and often the data that gets reported are small sample sizes or in particular groups of villages but not in other villages where conditions made it more difficult to make the measurement, for example. So we have to be very cautious, but there are early signs of a plateauing and even the beginnings of a downward trend in the proportion of certain age groups who are infected and who we're measuring systematically year by year by year. The key variable to watch is, for example, the proportion of 18-year-old girls who are infected. When that starts to plateau, there's some hope, and when it starts to come down, then that's a cause of great rejoicing, I think.
My final question, obviously the Global Fund is an organisation doing a large amount of work, raising a large amount of money. Do you think it's a danger if people look at the issue of, let's say, preventing HIV/AIDS and thinking, right, it's just a question of money, you know, as long as we get up to that target of 25 billion a year, great, we've done it. I mean, there's clearly more to it than that, isn't there?
There's much more to it than that, and it's a very good point you make, because it's the sort of beware the magic bullet point. And money is not the magic bullet. I mean, we need lots and lots of money, so money is an essential. It is a necessary condition, but it is not a sufficient condition. All those who are doing good work in Africa, the money has to reach them and has to be effectively spent by them in well-managed programs. Now, that's easy to say sitting in a room in Cambridge and really hard to do in rural Malawi. So there are many challenges beyond the finance and downstream from the finance.
That's Richard Feacham, the director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB and Malaria. And if you want to know more about them, check out theglobalfund, all one word, .org. Now then, we normally do a kind of a roundup of events that are happening over the next 2 weeks. And something that's happening for the whole of the next 2 weeks is what, Hannah?
Something that's happening for the next 2 weeks is Fair Trade Fortnight.
Well, hey, okay, so give me a rundown then. What's going on in Fair Trade Fortnight?
Well, one of the shops that we've actually featured on this show before, Arjuna, is really pushing this event, and it's a fortnight that happens annually to promote fair trade. and all the products that are linked to that brand.
So, yeah, I mean, fair trade then. Give us a quick, I don't know, bullet point message. What's it all about?
Fair trade is a way of doing business that gives producers in the developing world a better price, a fairer price for the products that they produce. So all sorts of things, coffee, tea, chocolate, mangoes, bananas, they're sort of the big ones that come under the fair trade banner.
Okay, and I'm sure everyone's seen fair trade around, but I suppose Arjuna is a fairly good place to get it, am I right?
It is a good place to get it, because places like Arjuna, they don't just sort of have the token fair trade product that somewhere like Sainsbury's can have, which it can be good as well, but you're supporting sort of a different way of shopping by going to an independent cooperative, so it's really good to buy your fair trade products there.
Okay, so if you drop into Arjuna then, what kind of things will be happening there?
Well, on the two Saturdays in the fortnight, the 11th and the 18th, there'll be different organisations that do lots of work to do with fair trade there. On the 11th, it's the Harambee Centre, who've been featured on the show.
We love them, yeah.
The Development Education Centre in Cambridge. And they'll be bringing lots of memorabilia, some fair trade games, giving away samples of fair trade products. And on the 18th, it's the Cambridge World Development Movement, who've produced a fair trade guide to Cambridge, and they'll be talking about their work and why it's important. And throughout the whole 2 weeks, there's a tombola going on for a fair trade hamper.
Stuff. Tombola? It's been a while since I did a tombola. Excellent.
So stuff full of fair trade goodies and lots of special offers at Arjuna and samples given away. And actually, the fortnight is not just limited to Arjuna. It's also going out to APU on Tuesday the 14th and 21st. So if you're a student at APU, check out and look out for them.
Now known as Anglia Ruskin University. So.
Very sorry.
There you go. Okay. Times they are changing.
They certainly are.
So there you go. Then that's from this weekend, the 4th and 5th to the 18th. Check out Fairtrade Fortnight mainly at Arjuna and also at Anglia Ruskin. Back to the show.
Excellent. Well, next thing coming up is an interview with Jinran Edie, a Chinese author, a Guardian columnist and a radio show presenter. She spoke on Monday the 20th of February at Trinity College about her work, particularly the charity she has founded, the Mother's Bridge of Love. One of the charity's aims is to bridge the gap between the West and China. I asked her how she felt China was misunderstood in the West.
I think because China is the country who has been surrounded by the big war, which is based different history period and also international understanding and between in the door or outside the door. So I feel and lots of Western media, when they talk about China, it's like someone standing outside of this castle and to tell people what they hear from inside. This is why I'm trying to do, is by my books or by my charity or by my media work as well, and to open tiny hole in this big wall, you know, then people can see what's going on inside. I have been working with Western media in many countries. Sometimes I feel very difficult. A, the information they got so old. B, they are so limited by the political colors. And C, they can't see China as the country with such a rich culture roots. It's something like China, just the result of the political.
One of the things you talked about in your talk a lot was the fact that there's a huge difference between sort of rural poverty and the urban sort of fast capitalist life. Is that something you could expand on?
I think because China just opened 20 years and also when they opened in the 1980s without enough international knowledge and also without enough and knowledge of the judgment as well. So as many countries happened after Second World War, lots of the cheap culture of fast food flood into China. So that made China, you know, looks like really is uneducated, but improved in certain level. This is why in the countryside, because the system, because the policy, because the political reason, and in the history or so far, never been touched by the modern lives. So there is a huge gap you can see between the city and the countryside. And I'm sure since Chinese government or Chinese people realize this has become a major problem, because China still is an agriculture country, and still 78% of the population, they are peasants and farmers. Mm-hmm. And more than half of them never been educated more than 3 or 5 years in their life. So this is could be big problem for Chinese development.
And do you want to tell us a little bit about what your charity does to try and overcome this issue and also the issue of misunderstanding by the West?
My charity called the Mother's Bridge of Love. The reason is, A, as a Chinese mother, I am, and I want to be part of this bridge to help Westerners, or particularly young people or Chinese, overseas Chinese, to understand what's going on in China, and also help Chinese to understand what we thought in the West about them. So I think information or exchange is very important for the understanding and develop in the future. And secondly, because over 100,000 Chinese orphans adopted by 27 countries. For them, and how to link between the active adoptive culture and the birth culture, this could be very important in their lives. And because I've been worked in China and traveled quite a lot during the 8 years between the 1989 to 1997, actually still I'm doing, and I know there's a big gap between the city and the countryside, so I hope we can do something for the children between the rich and the poor. When the children rich, that not means they rich in everything. Yeah. When the children poor, it's not means they had nothing. Sometimes they have a very rich knowledge of the nature of the land they grew up. So I think it's very important to help them to understand this. So this is what MBR is doing for three bridges, one is between China and the rest of the world, and one is between the adoptive culture and the birth culture. Another one is between the poor and the rich.
If you want to find out more about Xinran's charity, you can go to all the W's, Mother's Bridge of Love, all one word, all lowercase, .org.
And finally in this programme, what does Islam have to say about caring for the environment? According to Muzammal Hussein, who is the founder of the London Islamic Network for the Environment, it says a great deal. And what's more, some Muslims could be taking more notice of the big environmental issues of our time. He came to Cambridge recently to run a workshop on this topic, and as part of the University Islamic Society's Experience Islam Week, I took part and then talked with him afterwards. He began by telling me about the concepts of unity and balance in Islam and how these are very similar to concepts held dear by the more secular environmentalist movement.
Islam considers everything to come from one source, from the Creator, from God, and that's a principle of Tawheed, unity, and all of creation, despite its diversity. It reflects that unity, it functions as one whole unit, one interconnected system that really reflects also the environmental message that is the conscience of even secular environmentalism. It's this appreciation of interconnectedness, of wholeness. And there's also the concept of mizan, of balance, whereby there's a dynamic balance within creation, and that manifests in different ways. And one could say, for instance, that global warming and the potential for that to in fact go into a whole new phase, what's called runaway global warming, whereby the balance is tipped, the tipping point has gone beyond. If that actually happens, then scientists are saying that we will have no control over it. So from that point of view, the Islamic principle is a very sort of solid principle that is articulated in the faith, and that through this contemporary environmental problem, it shows us, you know, the real value of that principle.
So in front of us then, we've got two large pieces of flip chart paper, and I suppose flip chart paper is the universal currency of the workshop, isn't it? So this is what we've been working with, and you split everyone into two groups, and we discussed two questions. So looking at the first of them then, I wonder if you could tell me what the question is and a couple of the things that were pointed out as possible answers to it.
Sure. Well, the question asked of people to brainstorm practical examples as to how religion might encourage people to care for the environment. And so that particular group came up with a number of ideas around that. And one of them, which I feel is quite interesting, is the issue of vegetarianism. Whilst Islam doesn't ask people to propagate vegetarianism, what I find very interesting is that Muslims are the exact opposite often, in that we tend as a culture to eat far more meat, perhaps, and I've heard that we eat more meat than any other group in the country, in the UK. Yet within Islamic teachings, you know, there's, for instance, a verse that says, do not allow your stomach to be a graveyard for dead animals, which sort of implies to eat less meat and verge more on the side of vegetarianism, whilst meat is acceptable to eat as well.
Could I just ask about that as well? You know, what kind of benefits to the environment can we expect to see from, you know, less meat being eaten around the world?
Well, one that is often brought up by people within the vegetarian movement, if we can call it that, is the fact that it takes a large area of land to produce the same amount of food if we're rearing animals, because the animals have to eat the food first, and then if we then eat the animal products, then energy is lost along the way, and in fact that means much more, a larger area of land that is needed to feed the same amount of people if we have a high meat diet. So from an environmental point of view, if we're talking about sharing of resources and we want to feed a growing population, then I think we need to be careful about how we use our land, that we need to use it carefully and without wasting too much of it.
Okay, so that question was looking at how religion might encourage us to care for the environment. So moving on, I suppose there's a second question that was asked to the second group, kind of follows on from that. So what was it?
Okay, the second question that they were asked was, in the context of environmentalism in the UK, the group was asked to brainstorm contributions made, firstly by secular groups, and secondly by religious groups.
Yes, and I mean, which one of those had the greatest number of examples given?
Yeah, well, that was the idea, was to, I mean, you know, my own sort of feeling was that secular groups would be contributing more, and the people participating. It was very clear to them as well, and they said that in fact the secular groups have made more contribution in terms of environmentalism in the UK than the religious groups.
And I suppose this is despite the rather strong themes of, you know, balance and guardianship and so on. Do you think things have to change in some way?
Definitely. The question one might ask is, what role is there for religion if people can act in a morally beneficial way without that particular belief, then does it have a value? You know, I think it's important not to run away from that question, but to actually acknowledge the reality of the way things are in the world. I think we also need to bear in mind that many of the problems are made by secular institutions as well. For instance, the World Trade Organization is a secular institution, and you know, certain governments, they're not really acting in line with religious principles and are secular governments. So I think we need to, I would say that as much as secular organizations are actively involved in environmentalism, that also secular institutions are also more involved in environmental degradation as well. So I think that there's an imbalance in there as also. But there is a potential through religious teachings that people can secure themselves in something that is pretty deep. And that's partly the role of IFEC, the organization I work with, and LINE, to begin to articulate those concepts and to facilitate people to move towards the deeper teachings of the religion related to environmentalism that have been lost.
That was Muzammal Hussain, founder of the London Islamic Network for the Environment, also known as LINE, which you heard him refer to at the end.
So that's all from this edition of So Far and Yet So Near. And don't forget, you can get in touch with us on sofar@209radio.co.uk. And if you want to get the show regularly, you can subscribe to our podcast. The details are all on the 209 website.
So tune in or download in a couple of weeks when we'll be talking about Fairtrade Fortnight, famine, and a Muslim poet will be telling us all about his life. So until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.